December 11, 2012, Mayapur, India. Nectar of Devotion, Class 13. So today we're going to be doing chapters 8, 9, and 10. Tomorrow, 11, 12, and 13. So chapter 8 is just about the offenses. In chapter 8, it lists the offenses mostly in deity worship. So if you haven't taken the time to read through this list, please read through the list. These are basically, what does Krishna not like? So if you're going to be serving anybody, you want to again have the intention of pleasing them. What's the Sanskrit for that? Anukulyena. You want to have your intention to be to please Krishna. And if your intention is to please Krishna, you should find out what pleases him and what displeases him. Do we all have things that please us and don't please us? Yeah, we have ways we like things done and things that we don't like. Now, some of these you might be able to figure out logically, why does Krishna like that? Why does Krishna not like that? And some of them you might not be able to figure out. You know, why does Krishna want to be circumambulated this way and not that way? Why does he want obeisances with two hands and not only with one? Actually, Krishna used that argument when he stole the clothes of the gopis. And they were coming out of the water trying to cover themselves. And he says, offer your respects to Varuna, who you've offended. And they just went like this, because they were covering themselves. And he said, oh, he quoted this, said it's an offense to offer obeisances with only one hand. He's naughty, isn't he? Yeah. This is from Vrindavan, for me and for every... What is this? And this is for everyone?
Well, I'm sorry.
It's going to have some mystic power to expand. Here, you can find a way on the break to expand it so we can share it with everybody. Thank you. Obviously, some of these things we emphasize more in ISKCON than others. And if anyone has a question about the red or blue clothes, the answer is I have no idea. What's that?
My mother told me that it was because the Rani wears those colors. And
no, that's not what I mean. What I mean is that we have no problem with ladies wearing red or blue clothes in the temple room. We don't consider that an offense. It's not that you can't wear red saris or blue saris in the temple room. So. Yeah. So if you're going to ask me about that, my answer is just simply, I don't know. Some of these we probably could do better to follow. Talking loudly before the deities, speaking harshly to others before the deities. I like this one. You know, that Krishna will take a little leaf or water, but don't spend all your money on yourself and then just give Krishna a leaf. Some of these we regularly see problems with. People putting their back to the deities or like spreading their legs before the deities. If you have dogs or cats in your house and they're watching you cook, you can't offer the food. But you not offer any food except to the deities, which has been seen by dogs or lower animals. So you can't have, you know, animals in your kitchen watching what you're cooking. Ayendra Prabhu wrote a lovely thing about useless flowers without any fragrance cannot be offered. Now, he wrote a really nice thing where he compared himself to a flower without a fragrance. He said, I am the personification of the useless flower of offense. I just wonder if I could. One second. So Iyengar Prabhu compared himself. He said, I'm like a flower without any fragrance. He was asking Radharani to pick him up anyway and offer him to Krishna. And he said, how can you offer me to Krishna? I have no fragrance. So I thought that was really nice. Of course, we offer lots of flowers without fragrance, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, nowadays, the roses, they grow for beauty instead of for fragrance. And they have no smell. They look pretty and they have no smell.
Someone told us white flowers you can offer any etiquette. They don't have fragrance. True?
What do you ask them?
The etiquette.
What do you ask the person if they say that?
Oh,
that's interesting. Where does it say that? I mean, I don't know. But I don't see that here. Once you're not into the temple after touching a dead body, I don't think insects count. Or even after seeing a dead body. One should be angry with the temple, in the temple. Okay. All right, now we also have an interesting thing here on page 71. Where Srila Prabhupada goes on extensively about worshiping Ganesh. Now, I'll tell you why I find this interesting. When the devotees asked Srila Prabhupada, so we should worship Ganesh, Prabhupada said no. And then when they kind of pushed it, Prabhupada said, if you want to worship Ganesh, you have to give me a donation of $100,000 a month. Now, one person actually did that. That was how the Krishna Balaram temple got built. But seriously. But what I find particularly interesting is that the way it's written here is as an instruction. It's written there as an instruction. Therefore, all devotees should worship Ganapati. Now, there are certain things in Srila Prabhupada's books that are written as observations, not as instructions. Like Karna was considered low-born because he was raised by a charioteer family. That doesn't mean that if you're raised by a charioteer family, you should be rejected. So some of the things Srila Prabhupada writes are observations. There may be observations of materialistic life. There may be observations of other time and places, other cultures, some of which we should copy, some of which you shouldn't copy. But they're not instructions. Other things Srila Prabhupada writes are instructions. Do you understand the difference between observations and instructions? I'll give you a simple example of an observation. An observation that Prabhupada gives is that when he was a boy growing up in Bengal, you could tell a woman's status by how she wore her hair. He was saying you could tell a woman's social status by how she dressed. He said if she had cinder in her hair, then you could tell she was married. If she parted her hair on the side, you knew she was a prostitute. If her hair was loose or shaved and she wore white, you could tell she was a widow. Now, in thinking about this, in other parts of the world, do we have indications about a person's status by how they're dressed? Okay, how do you know in Western countries, how do you know if somebody's married? They have a ring. So we also have something. It's not that people in Croatia or, you know, Denmark or don't have any indication that a man or a woman is married. That's a useful thing to know, isn't it? So we also have that kind of indication. Now we don't have an indication whether or not somebody's widowed.
They
wear black all the time?
Interesting. If they're very traditional.
They're very traditional. Well, that was true also, you know. Actually, it was true in Europe a long time ago. They'd wear black for a while.
Like a year.
Yeah. But not forever, because generally in the European tradition, widows could marry again after some time. Okay? What about prostitutes? Do we have ways prostitutes dress?
Yeah.
For sure. How do you know? Can you tell me some of the symptoms? Sure you can. What?
really ugly shoes.
Especially very, very high-heeled shoes. What else?
Not
very many clothes. Very short skirts. What colors particularly?
Red.
Everybody knew that, didn't they? What about hair?
Loose
and what? What else can you tell me about hair? You're a Western prostitute? No. What about hair? Come on.
Blonde.
So if you see somebody with dyed blonde hair, a very, very short red dress, and very, very high heels, there's a pretty good chance that she's a prostitute. Is that true?
No, nowadays.
It is true that nowadays if you go in London on a Saturday night, it's hard to tell who are the nice girls. And I was thinking it must make it hard for the prostitutes to make a living. You can't put them out anymore. But I remember we were doing Hari Nam in the underground in London, and there were these girls we saw, and you could just immediately tell they were prostitutes.
But now they wear more underwear.
They're more underwear outside. They do something, yeah. They have to, otherwise they're not going to get any business. So they have to. And you look at them and you go, oh, that's a prostitute. Of course, now, as I say, sometimes you're not sure. But my point is that every society has ways that you can tell something about a person's status, just how they're dressed. Can we also tell, like, what kind of occupations people have by how they're dressed during a working day? During working hours, you can tell something about a person's occupation. Are they wearing a business suit? Are they wearing, paint-covered blue jeans? People do dress to indicate their social status, their occupation, their marital status, correct? Right? So that's an observation. It's an observation. Now, if we say, I'm going to take the Bengali way. By the way, are there different ways in different parts of India that women show that they're married?
They wear the bangles.
Yeah, so sometimes they wear the bangles. Some places they wear?
They wear the sindoor.
Sindoor
in the hair.
I think everybody in India
sometimes
really?
It's different colors.
It's
like
orange.
I saw orange.
Yeah. Right?
What about other parts of India? What do they do?
They're toe
rings. Right, when my daughter moved to Govardhan, everybody told her you have to wear cinder in your part, toe rings, and ankle bells, and they had like a whole list. And bangles. She didn't wear bangles, toe rings, ankle bells, sindoor. She did some. She didn't do everything.
Saris.
Yeah, in some places, married women wear saris and unmarried women don't wear saris. There are places like that. In South India, only widows cover their head. So there's different. And then Prabhupada says in Bengal, the married ladies cover their head. That's how you can tell when that a woman's married, is she covers her head. So there's different details may be in different places. So I take that as an observation. The Prabhupada was giving an observation that the women in Bengal, you could tell their status by this way, because every society has ways you can tell status. Why do you need to know people's status? Exactly, how to interact with them. You can figure out what relationship. First there's sambandha and then there's abhideya. Anyway. So, in other words, sometimes Prabhupada will just give an observation, sometimes he'll give an instruction. And one has to be able to distinguish, because observations are not necessarily instructions. But here is an instruction. I mean, that's interesting. It's a direct instruction. 71. Therefore, all devotees should worship Ganapati. That's Prabhupada's conclusion. Therefore, all devotees should worship Ganapati. Now, of course, there's many other places in Prabhupada's books where he says, don't worship the demigods. In fact, the majority of Srila Prabhupada's instructions are don't worship the demigods.
The Krishna book, it says that we should go to all the temples of the demigods.
We should. Interesting. So what do we do with this kind of stuff? Now, this is sort of a little expansion on make sure it's from Sadhu Shastra Guru. That's not enough, is it? So far I've given you that instruction. Make sure it's from Sadhu Shastra Guru. Make sure it doesn't come from the sky. make sure it doesn't come from, that's what they do in, you know, this village in Maharashtra, and therefore everybody should do it. What about this? What about the fact that Sadhu Shastra Gurus say different things in different places? So first of all, you've got to distinguish. Is this an observation? Is it instruction? Is it an instruction for me now? Is it a general instruction? Is it an instruction for me now? How do we figure that kind of stuff out? How do we decide when we read this on page 71 whether or not all of us should now go to the local shops and buy a Ganapati Deep? How do we decide? How do we know? Huh? Okay, but this Prabhupada wrote this. So you can go to your guru, okay? And you can also go to Srila Prabhupada and say, Srila Prabhupada, you wrote on page 71 of the Nectar Devotion that everybody should worship Ganapati. Do you want us to do that? Now, just recently, people have been making some point by quoting one of Srila Prabhupada's purports, which is not an instruction, which is an observation. And when Prabhupada was asked, he said, the purport says yes, and when he was asked, Prabhupada said no. He said, the purport says no, and Prabhupada said yes. So you can ask, is this an instruction for us? It says here, all devotees should. Does that mean I should? Does that mean we should? Does that mean all of our ISKCON temples should have a Ganesh deity? Some do. Hawaii does, right? Honolulu.
In the front.
In the front, there's a Ganesh. So, and that one thing you can do is ask. What's another thing you can do? What else can you do? Yes?
I have a question.
Yes?
Either we can look for another place where he says it also again.
That's a good idea.
But then, what if there's, more places where he says don't do it and less places where he says
okay, so this is the next step. The next step we see, is this discussed anyplace else? Some things are only discussed once. For example, there's only one place ever anywhere that Srila Prabhupada talks about chanting 50 rounds before having sex. It's in one letter in 1968, and it's never discussed any other time, anywhere, with anybody, in any purport, in any public lecture, in any context whatsoever. So sometimes there may be something that's only discussed once, and whenever else the topic comes up, it's not brought up. Another instance of that, something Prabhupada says twice in letters, he says you can distribute the prasadam in the pots while the offering is still on the altar. He says that twice in two letters. So something that Srila Prabhupada says once or twice, just in a letter or just in a conversation, if he never ever says that again in any other context, it's probably not a general instruction. So that's one way you can see. Does Prabhupada ever say again in his books you should worship Ganesh? And the answer is?
No.
So that's one indication. I mean, something Prabhupada really wants us to do, how often does he say it?
A lot.
How many times does Srila Prabhupada say we should chant at least 16 rounds? Not just once. Not just once. Or how many times does he say we shouldn't eat animals? Not just once. It's not just something he mentions one time. Good teachers repeat important things. Okay? A good teacher, if there's something important, they repeat it. So if it's not so important, they'll say it just once in passing. Alright, so the first thing we want to look at is this ever said again? Well, first thing we want to look at is, has anyone ever asked a direct question, which in this case they did, is this really something you want us to do? And you probably say, oh yes, install Ganesh in all temples. Or did he say, no, don't do it? And in this case, we can find a place where Srila Prabhupada was asked, so should we worship Ganesh? And Prabhupada said, no. So that's pretty clear. Okay. If we can't find that, if nobody thought to ask Srila Prabhupada, then we can see, did he ever give this instruction again? How often did he give it? Was it just a passing thing? I mean, there's one place in Bhagavatam where he talks about, this is a mantra, one of the verses, and he says, everyone in deity worship should use this mantra. And again, it's the only time he mentions it. Then you can see, is there any contradictory instructions? So in this case, what do we have regarding worshiping Ganesh? Lots and 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 lots of contradictory instructions. Lots, probably hundreds, if not thousands of times that Srila Prabhupada will say, don't worship demigods. We should respect the demigods, but not worship them. So that's also a really clear indication. So just to ask, is it in Sadhu Shastra Guru is not enough. You've got to know the context. And you really need to know the Shastra as a whole. So someone just pulls up some quote, oh, this says this over here. Now, therefore, those who really know the Shastras well have a big advantage in practicing Vaidhi Bhakti. Therefore, we have classes in Shastra. Therefore, we really take the time and the trouble to study the Shastra. We may not be able to convince everybody else, but at least we should know what is right and what is wrong. And if we're not sure, we can do some more research. Now, certain things, it's always consistently don't do this. Certain things, it's always consistently do this. Other times, it's different in different places, and then one has to see what is the context. Because a principle of truth is that most truth, almost all truth, is applicable differently in time, place, and circumstance. There's only a few truths that are applicable in all time, place, and circumstance, like always remember Krishna and never forget him. That's true in all time, place, and circumstance. Okay, chanting 16 mantras if you're in the hospital with a tube down your throat is not applicable, is it? Maybe you'll make up the rounds later when you get out of the hospital and the tube gets out of your throat, but that's something else. Make sense to everybody? Yes? Okay. All right. So, if you surrender to Krishna, you're free from all sinful reactions, 72. And even if you're an offender, you can be delivered simply by taking shelter of the holy names. Now, that doesn't mean you can do that intentionally. It doesn't mean you can just not care. Well, I'm just going to step over the flowers. Well, I'm just going to avoid offering obeisances. Well, I'm just going to yell at people in front of the deities. And then I'm just going to go chant Hare Krishna. And then I'm going to do it again, and then I'm just going to go chant Hare Krishna, and then I'm going to do it again, and then I'm just going to go chant Hare Krishna. That's just, not only is that an offense on chanting, but that just isn't even polite. Is it? It's just not very respectful to Krishna, who's a person. You know, I punch you, and then I say, oh, I'm so sorry. I actually had somebody in my life like this. You know, maybe you have too. So somebody, you know, they hurt you, and then they say, oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, I'm so sorry. And then they do it again. And then they say, oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, I'm so sorry. And then they do it again. And then they say, oh, I'm so sorry. Now, after a while, you're going to say, I don't believe you. If you're really sorry, then why don't you fix something? So Prabhupada says, Krishna will excuse once, twice, thrice, but not that you keep on doing the same thing intentionally. I mean, to do the same thing by mistake is one thing, but to do something, you know, just because you're... But even if you're making a mistake, you know, make some plan, do something. If you're forgetting something, make a plan to remember. You know, take some action to show that we're sincere. Okay, so other than that, other than intentionally, it says that one can become free from all these offenses by chanting Hare Krishna. There is a place where Srila Prabhupada said, if you offend the deities, you should recite a chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So that's generally what I do. I have my own deities at home. And if I commit some offense, if I accidentally commit some offense in their worship, then I'll read a Bhagavad Gita chapter. One time Prabhupada said, if you miss Mangal Arati, you should distribute one Krishna book. He talked about a family where the mother, the matriarch of the family, would fine the members who didn't attend Mangal Arati in their family temple. And he said, our fine is you should distribute one Krishna. Anyway, then Srila Prabhupada gives the list of the offenses on chanting. He says that you can be free of the other offenses by chanting, but if you commit offenses in chanting, you're finished. Of course, how do you get free from offenses and chanting? By chanting. Yes. And of course, there's some specific, if you offend a devotee, you should go to that devotee and ask forgiveness. If they don't forgive you, you should serve them. And then if they don't forgive you still, you should just chant constantly. There's certain also prescriptions. You know, if you disrespect scriptures, you glorify the scriptures, etc. So there are ways. It's also interesting that most of the offenses on chanting don't take place while you're chanting. They're sort of our general life. And of interest, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says particularly that it's by attentive chanting that one will be free of all the offenses on chanting. And if one's free of the offenses on chanting, then that nullifies all one's other offenses. And then if you have no offenses, then that nullifies all your sinful activities, and that's the end of that, and then you're done. Okay. I'm going to go on to chapter 9, unless somebody has something specific on these offenses they want to ask. Yes?
It's just a technical question, but there's an offense something you shouldn't do, which is touch a woman who's in her period.
Yeah, of course, you got to touch yourself.
but I mean, is that in general? Or
that's for that's for people worshipping the deities.
But not in the home or whatever.
No. When you're worshipping the deities, you're actually only supposed to touch people who are clean. I know, like, when I had a little baby, so I'd have to give the baby to my husband and take a bath before I could go on the altar, and then I couldn't touch my baby again before I touched the deities if my baby was in diapers. So the same, there's a story of Sanatan Goswami that when Mahaprabhu asked to see him, he didn't want to walk in front of the temple because he thought, first he figured that he was contaminated by having worked for the Muslims, and second of all, he felt contaminated because he had a skin disease that was causing oozing on his body and oozing itches. And he thought, if the pujaris, when they come in and out of the temple, if they accidentally touch me, they'll be contaminated. So he went around the long way, even though it was the hot season, and he had to walk on the sand. And when he came to see Lord Chaitanya, he had blisters on the bottom of his feet. And Mahaprabhu was actually very pleased with him, that he had this mood of humility that I don't want to contaminate anybody. So when you're worshiping the deities, you're not supposed to touch anybody who's unclean in any way. So if somebody hasn't bathed or whatever, you shouldn't be touching them and then touching the deity. Yeah?
One question is like the same. One should not enter in the temple in a contaminated state. This refers to when we have our fear?
It particularly refers, as it's explained there, to whether or not there's been a death in the family.
Just about this, not when we have our fear.
Well, I mean, Prabhupada specifically said the women could go in the temple when they had their period.
Just when we have some specific, worshipping deities or something like this, we cannot.
Yeah, I understand by entering the temple, Prabhupada often means the deity room, by the way, not the whole temple building. He really means the altar room. If you see where he uses temple the rest of the time, he's talking about going on the altar. Although technically, there are some strict Hindus who would not walk in the temple building on their period, or they wouldn't walk in the temple building if a family member has died. I mean, I remember one devotee in some part of the world who was a pujari, and one of his close family members had died. And he said, "What should I do?" And I said, "You've got a lot of members of the congregation that are from traditional Hindu families. And if they know," I said, "everyone knows," I think it was like his father, I said, "everyone knows that your father died. And if they see you going on the altar, they're going to criticize the movement." I said, "So, better not to do, why give them a reason to criticize unnecessarily?" I mean, that was my opinion. Other people might have a different opinion. Well, Prabhupada talks about here.
Yeah, so around the 12 and 15.
Yeah, different days. Yes.
I was wondering, the person says that these offenses are quoted from supplementary Vedic literature. What are those?
I don't know. I'd have to look back in the in the Bhakti Vasamrita Sindhu, where it was specifically mentioned.
I might have it in my, let's see if I have it in my notes here.
No, I don't have it here. It might be in the Waves of Devotion book, otherwise it would be in the Bhakti Vasamrita Sindhu.
And also, so I was thinking about this, and in the beginning, We're talking about how Rupa Goswami had really quotes from the Bhagavad Gita. Why does Rupa Goswami do that? Like, why does he write another book and quote from something that's...
Why not just use the Hari Bhakti Vilas? The Hari Bhakti Vilas, although it was compiled by Gopal Bhatta Goswami and commented on by Sanatana Goswami, there are sections of it that are more applicable to smartas or specifically applicable to householders. Bhakti Vasamrita Sindhu is applicable to everybody. Also, the Hari Bhakti Vilas does not deal with many, many topics that are dealt with in Bhakti Vasamrita Sindhu. So Hari Bhakti Vilas does not deal with all the different rasas and the components of rasa at all. And the Hari Bhakti Vilas deals with many topics that are not in Bhakti Vasamrita Sindhu. So here we have a little description of what is a bona fide guru. Hari Bhakti Vilas goes into details about what is and what is not a bona fide guru. So it's really like an overlap. Some things in the Hari Bhakti Vilas are also in Bhakti Vasamrita Sindhu, but many things in the Hari Bhakti Vilas are not in Bhakti Vasamrita Sindhu. Many things in Bhakti Vasamrita Sindhu are not in Hari Bhakti Vilas. So Rupa Goswami did extensively quote from Hari Bhakti Vilas for certain sections. And the reason is that Mahaprabhu gave, if you read in Chaitanya Charitamrita, a lot of these instructions here were given by Mahaprabhu to Sanatana Goswami, who was very much involved with the creation of the Hari Bhakti Vilas. Yes?
Can you explain a bit more about what is actually impure about having your period? Like, it's not just the physical thing. There's something about women paying the sin for killing a Brahmin.
Oh, that's from the Bhagavatam. That Indra made a deal with women that they could have sex during pregnancy in exchange for menstruating.
What?
By the Bhagavatam, you need it first.
What's the canto chapter?
It's the sixth. It's in the story of Chitraketu and Vitrasura. Sixth canto.
Okay, well, that actually doesn't answer my question because I thought it was related, but something
no.
Different. So can you...
That's not something that I would deal with in my daily life, as this really relates to what I'm doing in my life. I understand it that if you're in a village, they say a man works from sun to sun, but a woman's work is never done. So you're not married and you don't have kids, right? Right? Correct? Okay. So if you're married and you have kids, and you're grinding your own grain, and you're grinding your own spices, etc., 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 you're working really, really hard every day. And you get 3 days off a month where you don't have to do anything. Nothing. Not to do anything. You don't have to do any laundry, you don't have to do any cleaning, you don't have to do any cooking, you don't have to do anything. You get a break. Everybody leaves you alone, and you get a break. So for women in a traditional culture, it was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing that they got left alone. You know, and they got it. Menstruation Ayurvedically is a time when your body is doing a natural cleansing. And you got to do that kind of cleansing. Of course, also according to Ayurveda, you know, if you do a lot of physical activity, you work with fire, that your body doesn't get a chance to clean like that. So I see that's really a mercy in traditional societies. Now, in modern society, I don't know if anybody ever gets a break, man or woman, you know, with all of our fancy machines and this and that, and all we do is work harder. It's really interesting.
Well, I heard that you can, back in the day, a woman could kill a really pure Brahmana by looking at him during her menstrual.
Well, that's interesting.
So
I'm going to ask what the source is for that.
Some sort of consciousness seems going on.
That seems rather far out. That sounds like a folk story.
Okay.
That really sounds like a folk story. But there's definitely something, I mean, you'll notice if ladies live together, they'll all get on the same cycle. Have you yes. all noticed that? Mm-hmm. Yes, interesting. Yes. Mm-hmm. Also, a lot of us, our perceptions of the world change sometimes, like in the few days before or the first day of. Somehow our vision of reality gets really weird. It's probably better if we're off by ourselves somewhere. Yeah, I mean, really, it's probably better if we can just be by ourselves because everything irritates us to the max, right? That also happens to a lot of us in the beginning of menopause. Actually, one of my friends who's just starting to go through menopause, she said, all I want to do is be away by myself. And I said, yeah, that's actually natural. It happens to a lot of women. that they go through a time when they want like a few months to a year to just like be away from everybody. So again, in a traditional society, you could do that. The society kind of worked with the natural rhythms of the body and the seasons. And I don't know if any of you have ever studied Ayurveda, but Ayurveda is very, very much concerned with the rhythm of the day and the rhythm of the seasons and doing things, eating things in harmony with them and living in harmony with them. Whereas, you know, modern doctors, when they're interns and residents, they have to work sometimes 80 or 100 hours a week, and they have to stay up all night, and they'll talk about how they'll go through a tunnel from their living quarters to where they work in the hospital, and they never see the sun. They're actually trained to work out of the natural rhythms of the body and the world. So I see these things mostly like that. And, you know, anything can be twisted and perverted. You know, you take a time for a woman to go through a natural cleansing and a natural time to be alone and be relieved from her duties, and then somebody, most likely not a woman, decides that now she's, you know, some sort of a leper practically. But maybe that did good for her. Maybe that meant that everybody left her alone. I'm really sure that if you led a life like that, you'd be very, very happy to be left alone for a few days every month and not have anybody making any demands on you. And if they left you alone because they said nobody could touch you, well, all the better. You know, and if people were afraid that if you looked at them or you touched them, that they'd burn to ashes, good, and they'd leave you alone. And they wouldn't come in and said, oh, but can you please cook? There's no one else to do it. They'd be scared. And they'd leave you alone. That'd be, you know, a very nice thing.
Young women just keep asking me, so that's why I'm asking, because I don't know what to say.
I get this kind of question all the time. This is a recurring question. You know, Srila Prabhupada was really not very concerned about it. I mean, he wrote one letter where he just said, the Goswami Vidhi allows women to do deity worship on the period, but better not to do it. But the most important thing is don't stop the service for any reason. There's this definitely stuff in the Shastra, I mean, the stuff in the Bible too, not to touch a woman who's menstruating. So, and then all this other stuff seems to have come from whatever, folklore. There are some things in the Ayurveda about the health benefits from a woman to being alone and quiet during the time. Yeah.
One thing about this, that if the service shouldn't be interrupted, I remember Janashi was telling us how, not just for the menstruating, but even when family members died, he's saying sometimes people just close their altar in the home and just neglect the deities for so many days. And he was saying how you were saying about identity, which identity is more important to you? I'm the son of someone who just died, or I'm the servant of Krishna?
What a brilliant comment. Thank you. That's a very brilliant and insightful comment. So better if my father's just died that I don't worship the deity. If there's no one else to worship the deity, and Krishna has to go hungry because my father just died. Exactly. So. Of course, sometimes you can worship in your mind. You know, I don't really want to take out my deities in an airplane and set them up on the little tray table where people have been eating meat. And I'm not very clean, and do my puja there in the airplane, you know. So one can also do in the mind. Prabhupada instructed that to Jamuna in London. Any other questions on chapter 8, on the offenses? Specifically? When you're worshiping the deity, generally you shouldn't be talking. It's not that, you know, you're dressing the deity and you're offering artik and you're just talking to other pujaris.
Oh, it reminds me. I think it says also that you shouldn't, like, approach the deity in the dark.
Yes.
Like, so
you
don't freak him out or something.
Maybe, I don't know. As I said, some of these, it seems very obvious and intuitive what the reason is. And some of them, you're just like, you don't really know what is the particular reason. I'm going to come down to the fact that Krishna is a person. I'm sure he has a reason for all of them.
But sneak up on him?
Yeah, sneak up on him. That's also true as a practical reason. You can knock things over. So just like when we do the puja in the morning, the curtains are closed. Of course, occasionally we do public worship. So sometimes, like Jagannath Snani Yatra, we bathe the deity in front of everybody.
What's the reason behind that?
It's private. Would you like to take your bath in front of everybody? And for the intimate servitors, Krishna wants to come out fully dressed and decorated. Occasionally, you know, Jagannath does have a Snani Yatra where everybody can see him being bathed. But generally speaking, and then it's like there's a very formal Abhishek on festival days, which is a kind of worship like for a king. That's a little different. But his normal, his everyday bathing and dressing, you know, he wants to come out before everybody all bathe and dress. That's just for his intimate servitors. Anything else? Yes?
How toxic dating is Betel?
I don't know. I've never tried it.
I don't know. And life members can't.
Huh?
It doesn't say anywhere that one shouldn't be bad
though. Well, basically we shouldn't take anything that's intoxicating, even mildly intoxicating. Krishna's Krishna. Krishna also dances with the gopis, so you know. The only regulative principle Krishna follows is no meat eating, except in the universal form where he eats the soldiers. Krishna gambles with Radharani. He does. Krishna gambles with Radharani. You know that, right? Yeah. Balaram gambled with Rukmi. Didn't work out very well for Rukmi. And Krishna definitely, you know, his main consort is somebody else's wife.
That's extreme.
There are originally forms of betel that were not intoxicating and were tambula that were used as mouth freshener and were healthy for the teeth and the gums.
Maybe that's what Krishna.
Yeah, that's when you read about offering Krishna tambula, it was like that. So if you go and look up, you know, if you go and do some research, what is the history of tambula? So it was something, it was like a mint, but it was something that was actually healthy for the teeth and the gums and refreshed your mouth after a meal. But yeah, basically we shouldn't take anything that's intoxicating.
What about prasad?
Well, that's the idea that we're servants. So just like the place where the devotee's house where I go and eat lunch. So the servant eats the prasadam in another room. So any of you who are familiar with servant culture, I grew up with servants in a house. And the servants never eat at the same table. They always eat in a separate room, in a separate table. They eat after the main people of the house have eaten, and they eat, you know, first they're serving. Now, they might put aside something for themselves, but so they eat later and they eat in a separate place.
What about taking chanam? You know, sometimes if you have to take water.
Even chanamrita, what does it say here specifically? There's something. Maybe it's not. There's the next chapters. Let's see. 84, okay. Yeah, it's nothing. Okay, well, Charanamrita obviously is always seems to always be taken in the temple room in front of you. Yes?
I just feel it's so nice how this is the first time I've heard about this explanation how it's.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like it's changed. There's all different kinds of tambula. Yeah, there's all different kinds of tambula. It can be made with a variety of things. And some of them are intoxicating, but not all kinds of tambula are intoxicating. And it was considered, you know, not that long ago in Indian society, it was considered a very essential gift to give anybody. Yes.
So we feel manageable,
yes.
So
very obvious. It must be auspicious.
Yes.
Auntie, what did Prabhupada say about eating soya products?
Different things in different places. Different things in different places. Decide what you, which one you want to follow. Seriously. So different things in different places. He does not give consistent instructions on that.
Even about the chocolates too?
That's also inconsistent. Different instructions were given to different people at different times.
But it's interesting to see, one of the instructions talk about smoking marijuana or opium. I mean, Sanskrit words like this, or how is it?
You know, I'd have to go back and look that up specifically.
I don't have that.
It seems more of modern.
I don't have it. No, definitely not.
No, I mean, of course, yeah, Shiva.
In fact, I took this as being that it was something that was prevalent more at the time that it was written in that society. You know, every society has its culturally accepted or even culturally mandated intoxicants. I'm sure you know that. So in some, you know, in some societies it's coffee, in some it's tea, in some it used to be tobacco, although that's going. You know, in some it's alcohol, in some it's a thing called khat, K-H-A-T. So every society has some sort of intoxicant that's part of the culture. Right? That if you go to some social event that you'll be offered this intoxicant, that it's something that people expect you to take. Interesting, isn't it? Human life, you have developed consciousness, and if you're not going to go to self-realization, it's pretty hard to live in the world with full consciousness. Bhagavatam says two people are happy, the fool and the transcendentalist. So if you're not a fool and you're in the transcendentalist, material life is really painful and everybody wants to take some sort of intoxicant. So each society has its intoxicant. And my guess is that Rupa Goswami was referring here to the intoxicants of the people in his time and place. Like alcohol is a fairly recent intoxicant widely in India. I'm sure some people drank alcohol in India in Rupa Goswami's time, but it wasn't part of the social culture. It's just like in America, some people take heroin, but it isn't part of the social culture. It's something illegal and it's... You wouldn't mention in a book for a gentleman nobody should take heroin because that's already understood. You follow? But you might mention in a book for ladies and gentlemen that you shouldn't drink coffee or tea because that's very much part of the culture. Or that you shouldn't drink alcohol because that's very much part of the culture. So that's my guess on this, but I'd have to... Of course, this here in chapter 6 is just a list. But we could look up in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu in the later chapters when it's mentioned specifically, you know, what word Rupa Goswami is using and if there's any other commentary. But even the commentary, of course, was written at that time. Anything else on 8?
Vaishnavas are beyond the jurisdiction of Yamaraj.
Yes, that's true.
So I was actually wondering, like, is it true for all types of Vaishnavas? Like, someone who's just begun
Yamaraj tells, in the sixth canto, he tells his servants, if somebody has one time offered obeisances to Krishna and said, from this day on, I am yours, you leave him alone. One time said the holy name of the Lord, one time offered obeisances with sincerity, not just official, not just going to a church for a wedding, and, you know, but even one time been sincere that such a person is not under Yamaraj's jurisdiction.
Sometimes we say some Vaishnavas, they come to complete their life again.
Yeah, but they're not dealt with by Yamaraj. He deals with a different group of people. They're dealt with by Krishna and Krishna, you know, other servants. They're not in the prison. They're not in the prison department anymore. All right. I think we take a 15-minute break. Please make sure you stand up for at least 30 seconds in the break. All right.